Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Alpharetta, Georgia, it's time for Alpharetta Business Radio, spotlighting the area's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Your host, Chris Deekle, with Alpharetta Business Radio here today. We have three very exciting guests who talk like they're four. I think you're going to be very interested in them because they're all about having fun, making businesses work very well, and we have someone from the film industry here that you're going to really want to know about because he'll make you a Hollywood star in no time. We have in studio with us today, we have Kenny Zale, Making Teams Rock. Now, Kenny is a professional musician and has written the book that is responsible for more parent suicides than anyone in America, teaching your kid how to be a professional rock drummer. We have Alan Allard from Genius Dynamics, Inc., who is all about helping build teams through behavioral assessments. So I think you're going to find out how to use behavioral assessments and things to hire better and improve the team and skill levels in your company. And then finally, we have Dale Sizemore with Flips Film. He is an expediter for the Hollywood film industry, and practically everyone from Hollywood who comes in wants to talk to Dale because he smooths the path for helping bring the big productions that you see filmed around Atlanta. I mean, great things like Walking Dead and Night of the Zombie. Those are they would never probably be here without him. So let's move on to our first guest, Kenny Zale, Making Teams Rock. Tell us about your background, Kenny. You have a, how in the world did you get from being a professional rock drummer to being in the business world?
Well, after 15 years of being a professional drummer, I went into sales, and I quickly became a sales manager. And what I did is I used what I'd learned from engagement and interaction in the band and transferred to my sales team. And quickly, the sales team was doing sales awards, and they were enthusiastic and successful.
Well, what's the translation from being a musician, playing in a rock band or an orchestra in the business world?
Well, several things. First of all, like in music, everybody's playing the same song. So in a team, everybody's got to be having the same goal. And they have to focus on the same goal. And everybody has to be playing in the same key. So everybody in the team has got to be working together and not working separately.
I see. How do you go about building a team using what you've learned from the music world and, of course, your experience in the sales world and working with, that cast of characters who are probably the most difficult to corral a sales team?
Well, I think it comes down to there are four areas for engagement and for interaction. And those are the environment, the conditions that you're in, recognition, how am I perceived, purpose, why am I doing this, and then compensation, what am I receiving for it. So, for example, I do a lot of interaction activities for, let's say, industrial conferences or industry conferences, business conferences. And condition-wise, you're talking about what is the educational content in that conference? Who are they? What are the topics going to be? What are the speakers going to be? What I would do in my environment, I make sure that everybody is comfortable in what they're doing, the activity that we're going to be doing. Recognition-wise, I realize that some people can't do certain physical activities, so I make sure that the activities that I do, everyone can do. There's no one going to be turned into a scorekeeper or an observer or something like that. And then, in a conference, obviously, for recognition, you want to make sure that you're welcomed and they have first-timer meetings and things like that. For a purpose, why am I doing this? For most people, it's if they're in a conference, it's the education, it's the networking. And for me, when I'm doing my activities, I make sure that they are going to be able to network with the right people and they are going to have some fun. And then for compensation, obviously, when somebody goes to a conference, they're looking for new ideas, they're looking for new contacts, they want to feel good, and what I'm doing for compensation is I make sure that when they walk out of there, everybody feels better, has a better relationship with the people that were there on their teams.
What tools or techniques do you use to accomplish that?
I have several different activities. first one that I started out with was television-style game shows. I was in radio for quite a while, and I used to do corporate events, and they would say, do you have any kind of interactive activity we can do? And at that time, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire was popular on television. So I would do something similar to that, and then all of a sudden people said, well, what about, can you do something like a Feud? Can you do something like a Jeopardy? And I started doing those kind of activities. And then I added to that the audience response devices, so you can get a team together and they can be from all over the room and be able to click in right answers. Then I had where I had small teams where I do a retreat and there's only 10 or 12 people there. And so I have one called Competitive Advantage, which is like a sales simulation game where they can be as little as 4 or 5 people on a team. I've done ones where as many as 80, and we have like 17 different games going on at the same time. And then, of course, there's your typical things like a trivia show, something like that, that I'll do depending on, again, what the activity is and what the event is.
Now, you know, many of those are games. You know, why are games so popular, and how are they relevant to the behavior that you want to instill in people?
Well, games have structure. And, for instance, if you are going to a networking event, maybe it's in a conference. Many times what they do is they'll have a big room with a bar and a band, and you walk in there and you've got a network. Well, a lot of people can't do that. A lot of people feel very awkward about trying to get around and meet people. They don't like meeting people. So a game has a structure. It gets people involved instantly. And if you do something that has some entertainment value and also has some educational value, they'll buy into it.
I see. What makes a good activity? What components make up an activity that succeeds?
Well, what I like to say is that, first of all, it's got to be safe. A lot of people don't want to get involved in something until they know that it's going to be physically safe for them, emotionally safe. They're not going to be made fun of. Also, there's no repercussions. If you don't do well, your boss doesn't, you lose a promotion or something because of that. It's got to be challenging. It's got to be unpredictable, something so that they have some fun. It's worth their time to do it. And somehow it's got to be relevant to them, so that whether it's because we're doing networking, or maybe there's some educational value in some of the questions. Let's say if I'm doing like a Jeopardy-style game show, the questions may be dealing with product knowledge, or they might be dealing with the industry. I just had one a couple days ago where I worked with the Greening of Meetings conference, and all the questions that they gave me were all dealing with recycling, repurposing material at meetings.
I see. I wanted to circle back for just a second to what you said about the sales simulation games.
Mm-hmm.
Were those all salespeople, or were they people outside of the sales?
No, they actually were outside of sales. This was all engineers, IT engineers. And generally, you know, you're talking about those are more of an analytical kind of occupation. They're not very, you know, hands-on, shake hands, how you doing, pat on the back type, usually. So the idea of this game is that you have to work as a team at your table to win. And what you're doing is you're playing against the game. The game is basically taking market share away from you as a company. And if you don't work as a team, the game will win. So they learn real quickly they have to work together.
What other skills or insights do they take away from a game like that that would help them interact and work better with sales? Because I think if there are ever two poles on the planet, one of them is IT people and the other one is sales.
Yes. First of all, they learn that they have to communicate with each other. They learn that very quickly, that they have to talk about. Each of them has a separate kind of responsibility, something that they can do and the other ones can't. And so they start to strategize. All right, if you do this, then I can do that. So they start doing the strategy and planning together. That works real well. They also realize very quickly that they all have to work together because everybody has a different responsibility. And if they don't all do that responsibility, it affects the next person.
I see. And when they get through with that game, does that learning stay with them? Do they carry that over to the business?
Well, I try to do a debriefing afterwards so that they catch on as to exactly what they did and what they learned. And then we try to say, now, how would this relate to your business, or how would this relate to your job? And people will pretty quickly, you know, raise their hand and say, well, I thought of this, or I just had this incident, and this would have helped if I would have done that. So we try to make sure that they remember it once they leave.
Have you followed up with the owners to see what the results were after your program?
Yes, I do, and several of them have had me come back again because of that, because they realize that these people who generally don't network with each other started to work together, and that's something they were looking to do. And so they said, can you come back in 6 months and do another one? We have another group, or maybe we want some of the same people to come back and do it again. In fact, the last one that I did, some of the teams had beat the game, and we still had about a half hour left, and he said, can we do it again? that's usually a good compliment. Can we do this again? Sure.
Well, so the reinforcement and just the insights people take away do tend to stay with them. I think that's important because, you know, this may be one of the myths we want to talk about training and using games as learning vehicles, is that this stuff doesn't really apply. That you may go through the game, you may do the work, but it's gone the minute they're out of there. So,
yeah, you have to do some debriefing afterwards. You have, because what happens is when people get into a game, their guard goes down. You know, if people that, let's say, if you have some CEOs and they're playing golf, for instance, all of a sudden they get on the golf course, they're a totally different person than they were in the office. And so what happens is when you play a game, your guard goes down, you really are the person that you truly are. And that's where the learning starts. And so you have to make sure that you, at the end of the game or the activity that we're doing, debrief this and say, okay, what did we just learn? Because everybody now is who they really are normally and not putting up that front because I'm an executive.
So one of the myths is games don't work. What are some of the other myths?
That everybody is motivated by the same activity. I've got twin daughters, and I took them to Chuck E. Cheese one time. If you don't know Chuck E. Cheese, it's you walk in there, you get a bunch of tokens, you play it in arcade games, and they win tickets. And at the end, they get prizes. Well, my one daughter, she stayed at one game, played the same game over and over and over because she was real good at it, and she got a whole bunch of tickets. The other one was all over the place and giving tokens to friends and said, here, play this game with me and play that game. And at the end, I told him, I said, you know, the one who was playing one game, I said, you didn't have much fun. She says, oh, no, I'm going to get that big teddy bear at the end of the playing. The other one, I told her, I said, you're not going to get any prizes at the end. You're going to be getting the plastic spiders and the pencils and stuff like that. And she says, I don't care. I had a great time. So you're talking about twin sisters and thinking totally different about, you know, what motivated them.
Interesting. What are some of the other myths and things that business owners have said to you about your program that when you finally got them to try it, their attitude and their opinions changed?
Like I mentioned before about the IT engineers, many times they'll come and say these guys, these gals are not going to interact with each other. That's because we know who they are. They're not that type. If you find the right activity, they will. And so that's another myth that a lot of times I'll come and say, no, our guys don't do that. Our gals don't do that.
I see. When are interactive activities appropriate?
They work well for networking activities, both whether you're talking in a company or you're talking about a conference. They work well for an icebreaker. Before, let's say, at a retreat where before they get into the business, they want these people to really get to know each other a little bit better. It works well when you're bringing in a sales force from around the country who may not get to meet each other. This is one chance where they have face-to-face time together.
Give us an example of what kind of an activity that would be.
Let's say for that sales force that came in, this was a few months back. There were about 50 or 60 that came in from around the country, and they came in. And so what we did is we did an activity that was they had a what I call a cryptogram they had to solve. So it was a puzzle, and it was a code. And what they did is they had a budget that they could spend money on. And so the idea is they're trying to save money by trying to figure out the code, but they have to spend so much money that so they can get some clues. And the idea was to figure out what the answer was. And so they were both analytical working on the code and also how much money. Okay, we'll spend $50 and we'll get four letters here and this and that. And at the end, you know, again, they were working together, and we debriefed that whole thing and how they all worked together, people who did not know each other whatsoever.
Fascinating. The sales retreats I've been on, I think one of them was, well, let's just say we had a lot of fun because we went to Camelback, and after that year they said, never again will you let you people darken our doors.
Yeah, it's got to be fun, but there's got to be some relevance to it.
I think the $50,000 damage that we did to their clubhouse, you know, probably played a part in that.
Yeah,
but that's not the kind of interactive activity you're suggesting.
No, all mine are indoors, first of all, and they don't involve alcohol usually.
Well, you know, I'm dying to ask your question because I saw the title of your upcoming book. Did Beethoven do the dishes? And I'd love you to tell our listeners about that.
All right, that is mixing what I learned from being in a band and an orchestra and my sales team and how to create an effective team. And what I did is I went through the different steps. A musician, first of all, always is playing their instrument. You wouldn't have a bass player playing a trumpet, for instance. So you make sure you work with their strengths, what they do well. They always have a musical part. They know what they're doing. So they know what their responsibilities are. They're not all of a sudden thrown like, I didn't know I was supposed to do that. Another part was, like I mentioned before, about the song. Everybody is playing the same song. So you don't have somebody playing in a different key. You don't have somebody taking a solo when they're not supposed to. Same thing in business on a team. You know, they all have that same goal. They all know what their responsibilities are. Another part is in an orchestra or a band, everybody receives applause or no one receives applause. You don't go and say, okay, let's hear it for the drummer. Okay, let's now hear it for the trumpet player. Now let's hear it for the violin player. It's the whole band, the whole orchestra that gets the applause. And so you have to make sure that your rewards that you're doing are for the whole team and keeps them together. Because once you start splitting them up, then you have competition.
Musicians, I suppose, are fairly easy to figure out whether they know what they're doing or not. Because either they can play the instrument and do whatever. I mean, I can barely listen to, you know, to music. And certainly I'm not musically inclined, but... What are there other factors that might make a terrific drummer or trumpet player just not fit in?
Oh, yeah, personality.
Oh, yeah.
They could be, you know, you could have a great jazz guitar player, but that doesn't mean they can play rock. You know, you wouldn't want to have somebody like Eric Clapton playing on a rap song probably because that's just not his style. He's not going to gear himself to playing that way. So, yeah, you've got to learn the personality of the people. And in business, it's a little bit more difficult than it is in music. I mean, music pretty quickly, they knew what they can do. They know how they play, and you can hear them instantly whether it's going to be a fit or not a fit.
I see. Well, fascinating, wonderful way to bring teams together, build your business, and impart skills that people didn't have when they started. I'm sure there'll be a lot of people that want to know about this. How do they get in touch with you, Kenny?
Best way is if you email me, it's at kenny@makingteamsrock.com. I'll be able to help them out or give them any advice that they might need for doing an event of some sort.
Well, thank you so much for being on this morning. Can you remain with us in the station while we go through our other guests?
Oh, sure.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Russ.
Let's go over to Alan Allard with Genius Dynamics. Now, the genius part just left me completely out.
Good morning, Chris. Yeah, that's what everyone says. But don't sell yourself short. You bring a lot to the table, obviously.
Well, about 200 pounds, which my doctor keeps harping about, but that's another story. I think the segue to you is really interesting because, you know, in a band, you can have people that can play the instrument, but they don't fit in.
Exactly.
And that's really what you're all about, isn't it?
Well, yeah, exactly. It's about helping companies to attract and hire and develop the right people for the right roles, and that can get complicated. As you said, and as Kenny was saying, you can listen to a musician trying out for a band, and you can find out instantly, hey, do they have what it takes in terms of skill? Mm-hmm. Well, even that part's more complicated for businesses because unless you can have someone come in and do what you're needing them to do in a short period of time, you can't really test even the skill part out as much as you'd like. But the real hard stuff comes in, as Kenny was saying, and that comes into the personality. Because when someone comes in for an interview, of course, they're there putting their best foot forward, and they're there to sell themselves, and most people are fairly good at it. So in an interview, trying to figure out, okay, what drives this person, what motivates this person, and are they going to fit in, is more difficult than it seems.
And that's really critical for a business, isn't it, to have this fit?
Absolutely. And I use the term behavior more than I do personality. So when we talk about assessments, I use the term behavioral assessments, and here's why. When you hire someone for a particular role, you need for them to perform at a certain level. So that means you need for them to have the right behaviors that allows for them to perform at a very high level. So we need to find out, this person that I'm taking a look at, how do I know if they have the behaviors that I need to do the job right? So whether you're hiring a safety officer or whether you're hiring a salesperson, the question is, how do I know for sure, do they have the behavioral capacity to do the job in the first place?
That's interesting. We've heard the term behavioral assessment as employees, and usually that means, okay, this is a chance to fail.
Exactly. You know, I hear that a lot. Employees are a little bit skittish about taking an assessment because they view it, and I think you use the word test, they view it like a test that they could pass or fail. But that's really not the way it is. A behavioral assessment isn't something that you pass or fail. It is simply something that reflects back what is a person's natural predisposed behaviors. What do they naturally and easily most like to do in terms of behavior? So instead of worrying about it, the better approach is to say, let me find out for sure from a validated assessment what my natural predisposed motivating behaviors are so that I will know where to plug them in so that I can excel.
And by behavior and the assessments, we're talking about how people view the world, what they're, are they strong, pushy people, or are they the quiet ones that sit in the corner and just want to do the job?
Yeah, those are some good phrases. The behavioral assessment that I use, the predictive index, measures four different factors. Mm-hmm. It measures what we call dominance. So if you're needing someone to come in and make something happen, for instance, I know, Chris, you've started and you run several businesses. That is the trait of someone who has a driving need to create things and to make things happen. Well, is a company wanting someone to come in and lead and drive change? They need to make sure that they have that behavioral capacity. So we look for dominance. The other factor is extroversion, meaning how much does a person tend to gravitate toward people versus gravitating toward tasks and technical things. So, we can say, well, is that person a people person or are they more a task or a project-focused person? So that would be the extroversion. And then the next factor that we measure is what we call patience. And that sounds a little different than what it is. Here's what we mean by it. We're talking about the pace that someone works at, how fast or maybe not so fast they like to work and move through life. So if you're needing, say, a salesperson, you're wanting someone who has a high sense of urgency, who has the mindset of, I'm going to make something happen today. Not someone who says, hey, I'm going to take things nice and steady and slow so that I make sure that there aren't any mistakes made. And the fourth factor that we measure is what we call formality, which basically means going by the book. So how careful to detail and doing things, quote unquote, the right way, or kind of playing it a little bit loose. So a company needs to know, does this person have the behaviors to really go out there and sell, if that's what they need them to, or do they have the behaviors to come in and make sure that all of the books are done exactly right and exactly on time so that there are no errors? Those are two different types of behaviors and personalities.
How many companies get this right and put the wrong people in the wrong slot?
You know, that's a great question. I think the honest answer is that every single company, to some degree, is going to miss the boat on this because we can't do anything perfectly. But here's what people need to understand. Companies that are not using a validated behavioral assessment, that means they're simply relying upon a manager's interviewing skills and upon their experience and upon their gut to make a hiring decision. And I can guarantee you companies that are doing that are making incredible amount of mistakes that's costing them an incredible amount of money. And here's why. You cannot identify and put your finger on what a person's natural predisposed behaviors are, even though you've been around them a long time, because it's a little bit more complicated than that. When I do assessments, as a matter of fact, Chris, you took the assessment about 7 or 8 months ago. I could bring someone who's known you for a long time, and they might be right about maybe one or two of those behavioral factors, but I can guarantee you they would be completely missing the boat on a couple of them. So that's someone that knows you well. If a manager is interviewing someone for the first time and they're thinking they're sizing them up, and a lot of managers pride themselves on that, they're mistaken. Peter Drucker said that executives, so we're talking about seasoned people that have been interviewing for a long time, only get the hiring decision right about 33% of the time.
Yeah, behavioral assessments will help that. And I was interested in the term you used. You said validated assessments.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and tell us what a validated assessment is. And I know there are a couple of real popular ones out there, Myers-Briggs and DISC, and what the contrast between all these are.
Well, you bring up a very, very good question. I tell managers, executives, that when it comes to hiring, they should only use an assessment that is EEOC compliant. Otherwise, they're just inviting the possibility of a lawsuit that they don't have much of a chance to win. So that's one of the first questions that they should ask. Does this test meet the rigor of EEOC compliance? Now, a lot of the tests that companies use do not meet that. For instance, Myers-Briggs and DISC, which are both good tests, people love those, but I warn companies, don't use those assessments for the hiring process because they are not EEOC compliant. And if you go to the publishers of those assessments, they will tell you that right away, and they will tell you that they are not recommended for the use in the hiring process. Now, what those assessments can be used for in a safe way would be for team building, conflict resolution, some aspects of employee development. That's fine. But from a legal standpoint, from keeping a company out of trouble, they need to make sure that it is validated, and they need to make sure that it is EEOC compliant.
And how does one gain EEOC compliance?
Well, you know, that takes a much more specific expert in that area than me to answer because it's a little bit complicated. EEOC, as you can imagine, being the entity that it is, has a tremendous amount of rigor built in to meet their qualifications. So let me just say it's hard to meet those qualifications. When you find an assessment that does, then you can have some faith in it.
How can you use your assessments in the hiring process? I mean, I'm going to hire a salesperson. How would I use that?
Okay, great question. If I'm talking to a sales executive, first of all, let me say I usually ask the sales executive, how many salespeople do you have? Let's say they tell me they have 30. Then I'm going to say, well, how many are in the top? How many are your top performing salespeople? And they're going to give me a relatively small number. Maybe it's going to be 4 or 5 out of that number. And then you're going to have people who are performing at the lowest bottom. And then, of course, you have those in the middle. So let's say that someone comes along and says, I want to replace my bottom 25% of salespeople, and I want you to find me people that will perform at the level of the top 25%. Can you do that? And I'll say, absolutely. We do that day in and day out for small companies and for the largest companies. And here's how we do it. We use two tools. The first one is called the PRO, And I'm not going to go into the details about that, but here's what it does. We have to find out, what does salesperson mean for each and every company that we're working with, because it's not the same. A salesperson is not a salesperson is not a salesperson. You have inside salespeople, you have outside salespeople, you have, I'm sure you've heard the term, hunters and farmers. Very different behaviors that are required for that. So we go in and we use that tool that we call the PRO, Performance Requirement Options, to find out, Chris, for your company, for your culture and what you need, what are the exact behaviors that you need for a top performing salespeople? So we get that first, and then we have a template. We have a behavioral map, if you will, for what you're looking for a salesperson for that particular role.
You can assess intelligently and hire smart.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the way that you have to start is you have to define, what do we need in a top-performing salesperson for our company or a top-performing general manager? And so we use a tool to identify those behaviors to get a behavioral map that we then use after we give all the incoming candidates the predictive index assessment and we get their behavioral profile. Once we get a candidate's behavioral profile from the predictive index, then we compare it to that first pattern from the PRO, and we see how closely it matches up and to what extent it doesn't match up. The question is, can we coach and train and close that gap for that person?
That's a great point. And I wanted to use that to segue over to another question,
okay,
which is, how do you use your assessments to build a team and develop the people in it? Or maybe put them in the right place. I mean, I always said my business, 98% of my job is put the right person in the right place where they can succeed.
You know, absolutely, because if you don't have the right person, they're not going to do very well, and they're not going to be very happy. That means that no one's going to be very happy. Their boss, customers, their coworkers. So, let me clarify the question. Are you asking how do you use a behavioral assessment to develop employees that you already have in place?
Correct.
Okay. We have the company give the assessment to every single employee in the company. Number one, that finds out, do you have some people that are not in the right place? And that's going to be the case. So hopefully then the company can find some other place within the company to plug them in that they're really going to excel at and that they're going to love doing. Now, the ones that you find out are in the right place, then you use the behavioral assessment so that the manager has the insights from the information and data from the assessment to know how to communicate with and to lead and to tap into that person's natural motivation on a much more effective way. Most managers pretty much are leading and communicating with their team pretty much the same, one size fits all, because they do not know what is each individual need from me in terms of different types of communication or different types of ways of relating to them. So a great assessment will give you specific information. It's what Kenny was saying. He's got two twin daughters that are motivated entirely differently. So if a manager is trying to lead and quote-unquote motivate two people the same way, he's going or she's going to be missing the boat to some degree, not getting the performance out of them. So we use the information to know more about how to more effectively lead and get better results.
You'd put one on one machine, they'd be driven to maximize what they could get out of that machine, and it didn't matter. They were results driven. The other person is much more people oriented and would fit an entirely different position in a company.
Absolutely. So if someone is more people-oriented, then the manager wants to make time to build that relationship, to ask, hey, how are things going in their personal life, and to chit-chat a little bit, to show that personal concern. But if someone is very task-focused, let's get to the point type of person, and let's keep personal things out of it, then the manager needs to adjust to that. And a behavioral assessment will give you all that information. The predictive index will give it to you at a glance because it's in a graph form, and you can learn that very, very quickly.
I see. Sounds eminently valuable, something that everybody should be using in business. What are the challenges in marketing something like this and getting the business owners that, I mean, this is clear off of their radar, and getting them to adopt this as a business requirement?
Well, that's another great question. Probably the greatest challenge is getting any business owner or leader or executive in a company to do something different than they're already used to doing. Because human beings are used to doing things out of repetition and out of pattern and out of habit. So the first thing that a leader needs to step back and take a look at is, hey, if I want different results, maybe it's time that I think about doing something I haven't done before, doing something different. So that's one thing. The other thing is just lack of education. The larger the company, the more sophisticated they are and their leadership, and the more likely they're using validated behavioral assessments, the smaller, the less likely they are. So smaller companies need to be asking themselves, what are the larger profitable companies doing that I do not know about and that I am not doing? And maybe if they're doing it, such as using behavioral assessments, one of our clients is Chico's, the women's clothing store. If Chico's is using it, then maybe it would work in my small business as well.
Interesting that you have a great tool, and certainly small business, really with rare exception, you know, they don't have HR people on board.
Absolutely.
That, you know, are the people that really know about this sort of thing. It's off their radar, you know, trying to break through and get to the owner. I mean, it may be a fairly good-sized company, too. I'm sure you've run into some that are, you know, your jaw is hanging down because, you know, you mean you're not doing this?
Yeah, absolutely. One of my newest clients does about $3 million a year. It's a retail business in the music business. And their colleagues from across the country who are the high-performing retail stores in the music business kept telling them, you've got to use predictive index. You have to use it. Don't hire anybody without using it. You need to use it for training and developing your people. But the business owner, you know, wasn't quite convinced until things kind of reached the tipping point, and they said, again, he said, well, maybe if I want better results, I'm going to have to do things a little differently.
Keep doing what you've been doing, et cetera.
Exactly. Absolutely. So when small companies don't have the HR departments, they need to make more effort to find out, okay, what are we missing that we need to know about and implement today? Otherwise, we're going to continue to do pretty much what we've done.
Now, when we were communicating earlier, you said you had something for our listeners that would help them. What is that?
Well, Chris, whenever I do a radio show, I always make a special offer to the not-for-profit organizations so that I can give back to the community. And that is, I will come in and give free behavioral assessment to all the board members and the senior leadership, and then do a debrief with them so that they can see how they can use the insight from behavioral assessments to communicate better, to lead more effectively, and to get results on a much higher level. So that's for a not-for-profit organization that would like to get better results with their leadership team.
I've had several people on who represent nonprofits that are helping our veterans as they reintegrate into the business world. We have 386,000, I believe, coming out of service next year.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a perfect example of someone that, you know, and of course you couldn't give 386,000 of these things away.
No. But no.
No matter how big-hearted you are.
Yeah.
But for some of those people, wouldn't that help them really pinpoint where they would fit best in an organization, what their skills really are?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And don't have time to go into detail, but suffice it to say that the information from a validated behavioral assessment gives you a lot of insight in terms of, hey, is that job role within that career really a good idea for you or not?
Well, thank you. It's been fascinating because you and Kenny really are two sides of kind of the same problem. One is getting the right people to start with. And then the second piece is bringing them together and taking, you know, this kind of natural fit that you create and develop that into a cohesive team that works well together. So it's really quite interesting that it's almost two sides. People are complicated creatures.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, Alan, if people want to get up with you about Predictive Index, how do they do that?
They can go to my website, alanallard.com, so alanallard.com. Find my phone number there or my email address and just reach out to me. And I will offer to all of the listeners, if they would like a white paper on how to attract and retain and develop top talent, I'd be happy to send them that white paper.
Well, super. Thank you for being on. Can you remain in the station while we get to our last guest?
I would love to.
All right. Well, let's go over to Hollywood. Tell us about your company, Dale, what you do and why it's so important and one of the reasons why Atlanta is seeing so many people bring big movies here.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it, and I appreciate Alan and Kenny. I've actually had some of those assessments, and they're scary accurate, and it really does do a good job, and it does help pull the people together to work off a common theme and a common song, as Kenny was talking about. That's the same kind of thing that the movie industry and the entertainment industry faces all the time. They pull together a lot of people very quickly for a short amount of time with specialized skills, and they have to handle a lot of moving parts. And the financial implications are profound if they get it right or if they get it wrong. So the ability of finding the right people and the right tools and cutting through the roadblocks that sometimes are there is what we do. And about 2 years ago, actually it was December 7th, 2010 at 7:15 in the morning, I was reading an article in the newspaper that said, government does not always make it easy to film in our communities. And I had 25 years of information sharing technology experience, and I said, I can believe that might be the case. Somebody must have done this. Did a deep dive, and no one was actually doing this on a consistent basis for the local governments. Local governments have to do permitting and approvals and coordinate. You just don't show up and start filming, even if you don't have a formal permit requirement. You just don't show up and start filming and setting off pyrotechnics. So every community who wanted to attract the filming, they've done a good job of tax credits and things like that promoting the states, but that becomes an arms race to the bottom. You know, there's 37 states that have got some sort of a tax incentive. So how do you make it easier to attract someone to your community? Well, give them better service. There's one way. And you don't have to move the needle very much to be able to make an impact on a cash-starved community. One of the ways you do that is you look at the kinds of things that local government, in particular, has been able to do pretty well. But when it comes to handling complex projects like a film, they don't always get it as well as they should. And they can't just have call me as well-intended as I may be there, nights, vacations, holidays, and those kind of things. Offload that. Just like multiple listing service helps realtors. There's 2.2 million ATMs. Offload a lot of that so that when communities and filmmakers need to engage in real time, it makes best sense. Single version of the truth.
Now, how much is a movie worth to a community?
An average feature film is $41.7 million in Georgia. Florida did some numbers and statistics last year. And you look at commercials and big ones and little ones and stuff like that, and their average was in the range of $34,000 to $40,000. Now, that may not sound like much, but it's a pretty easy way to inject some economic development into your community. I say they're kind of like rich relatives. They come to town, they spend lots of money, they fix things up better than they found it, and then they go away. You know, you don't have to worry about rerouting the utilities or building new roads. And
you have different relatives than I do.
Well, they're not rich, but nonetheless, it's a good plan for economic development. So what we do is we have an online portal that is customized for each community. It doesn't require any expensive integration, anything like that. And we normalize all these disparate departmental policies so that you have them in one place, 24/7, people across time zones can look at this and apply for it and get notified. We have some business rule magic that we put in there. And it lets everybody work from a single version of the truth, fewer unforced error. A lot of us have heard about the driver's license requirements. You know, you got to go prove this and prove that, and people grouse about that. Okay. Imagine if you had to go to every city and every county and get the same kinds of policies in a different format to get a driver's license. That's what the filmmakers encounter. Everybody does the same thing differently, and they're all right for lots of good reasons. How about giving them a way of enabling a navigation through the scavenger hunt of a complex policy so that you don't get a city official or county official show up with their arms crossed and shut down production?
I'm sure you've run into some situations that are just horror stories. What are some of the worst?
Well, there was some of the policies are well-intended. They wanted to know the home and address and phone numbers for the all the members of the executive team. I don't think Steven Spielberg is going to give his home address, you know, or Tyler Perry is going to give out his information because somebody in a department wants it. Others had some very interesting concept. They wanted to hang an ethnically challenged zombie in the courthouse square. And, you know, the community was trying to explain to them why that was not a good idea. Or another production that wanted to have a couple of guys running around with a gun at the courthouse parking lot. You know, it's just a couple of guys, you know. They don't always understand in perspective why these are not good ideas. And at the same time, governments also come up with some kind of huh moments too, and but it's a challenge. And what we're doing is helping bridge that gap between them.
How much time does that take out of the process? From, you know, movies. Okay, I'm funded. I've scouted some places. I want to do something in Georgia, and I need Roswell and Alpharetta and Dahlonega and, you know, wherever.
Of course, it ranges. Some of the bigger productions have more lead time, but I saw one permit up in the northeast United States the other day. 14 days advance notice we have to have, even for a simple one. Contrast that with Henry County, who got a big production about 2 weeks ago using our service, and a major motion picture asked to apply on Friday morning, and they were starting to film the end of the next week, and they got approval to do it. That's the kind of stuff, and it is more accurate. And everybody got an ability to vote in and weigh in and say, are you going to have that many vehicles? You know, where are you going to close the roads? It brings them together quickly and easily. The marketplace has changed so much. The cost of technology is coming down. There's more filmmakers, more entertainers, specialized channels, just like this radio show. You know, it's cost effective to do that. As a result, you've got an inch deep and a mile wide of production teams. They don't always have resources with long-term experiences. So you've got to be able to normalize that through technology, make it easy and better, faster for folks.
Yeah, and that's brought a lot of money to Georgia. How much money do you think you've brought into Georgia as a result of your service just here in this state?
Well, you're very kind to have mentioned at the beginning of the show the impact. A lot of those folks were doing this. They were doing it before Dale, you know, woke up one day and decided to do this. The movie industry is a $59 billion industry, but there was a $59 billion industry with a lot of headaches, and they had a lot of production delays and things. So what we do is provide some pain relief to those kinds of people. The kinds of value that were brought into communities, I can say that there have been a number of reality TV shows that have come to Alpharetta as one of my customers, Forsyth County, Habersham County, Bullock County, people like that. Some are further along than others. There's a lot more of the incremental spice on the cake and the frosting on the cake that is enabled by my services.
How many movie makers are you in contact with?
I'm speaking tonight to 63. I was at a film screening last night, and there was a room full of folks there that were involved with it. But there are thousands and thousands of people in the Georgia area alone that are involved with the movie industry. This has gotten rave reviews from people from Hayhira to Hollywood. In fact, one of my new associates is a Golden Globe voting member. He's one of 88 in the world, and he's just so excited. He said, this is a 10-carat diamond. And he has been talking to Europe and Romania and Czech Republic and said, oh, you got to do this kind of stuff, because he sees the value at the studio head level.
I see. When you're working here, you can see the value. Do the county and city officials get your message?
Surprisingly so. Many of them do. Some don't. They haven't yet. I'll just put it like that. I'm going to sick Alan on with some behavioral analysis on that. But some of them do. And some of the ones that get it the most are the ones that you would think get it the least. Law enforcement, fire marshals, people like that. Who you would normally think would just be very resistant or very open to this. I had one fire marshal, after learning about this and participation, almost hugged me. And he said, you know what you've done here? And I said, no, Chief, what do you think? And he said, you have allowed me to meet my contractual obligations for response time because I can set diversion routes for that community. I can go through different roads. And it's like, wow, okay, that's nice to know. So there is a big impact on it. And again, you don't have to move the needle very much. When you're talking about a service that's about 68 cents an hour, to bring in $34,000 a day, or in case of the Motion Picture Association, a couple hundred thousand a day, you know, you can't hire an illegal alien in a dinosaur outfit signed by the interstate for this kind of money. So it's a good impact. The impact on a community for years to come is profound. To me, it is, anyway. The number one tourist attraction in Northern California is Alcatraz. Stopped doing business in 1963 as a prison. Gets over 1 million visitors a year. Why? Film and TV impact. If you can bring them here and showcase your community, they'll remember it. They'll tell everybody that they know, good or bad.
Speaking of telling everyone you know, what happens on the, you know, what's the flip side of a community getting this wrong or a state getting this wrong?
There was a recent article in the industry by a noted filmmaker, now film financier, and I won't say the name of the state, but his article, Why I Won't Film in This State and You Shouldn't Either, because they had a vacillating policy on film tax credits and other things that were necessary to plan appropriately. When a community has the Department of No as their first experience, the filmmakers just say, I'll take this business elsewhere. Unlike refinishing your basement or something like that, where you can't take it somewhere else if you don't like the regulations, you have to move. Filmmakers go, you know, I appreciate it. Thanks very much. We'll go somewhere else. And they'll move on and spend their hundreds of thousands of dollars in some other community at the same time telling everybody they know, don't film over there. These guys are not receptive.
I've got to ask the question, is your service for Hollywood or is it for your local video producer?
Yes. It actually serves them and another constituency, the local vendors. We actually will showcase the vendors that support Alpharetta or Habersham County or whatever. So we are actually able to spotlight them a little better. It is a service that the filmmakers would use. There's no charge to them for the core service because we want them to use this a lot and embrace this and demonstrate to the communities this is a good way of doing it. And it reduces the unforced errors in the production process. For the communities, it lets them do more with less, extend their personnel 24/7. Everybody's looking at the governor's budget all the way down to city governments, cut back on the budgets. It lets them extend their people so that when they do have to meet, they can do it online, and I mean, they can do it in person and make good sense. So it's for everybody.
Now, fantastic. So if people and the videographers and the Hollywood moguls that are sitting around in their hotel rooms in Atlanta want to get in touch with you, how do they do that?
www.flipsfilm.com, FLIPSfilm.com. Stands for Film Location Intelligent Planning System. That's where Flips comes from. FlipsFilm.com.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for being on board this morning. Interesting show about behavior and about how you can make movies the easy way with Flips Film.